Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Your academic programs begins today, most appropriately with a lecture by Professor Andre Betey, who is one of the most distinguished sociologists India has. It's my great pleasure to formally introduce him. Professor Andre Betey is Professor of Sociology at the University of Delhi. He has been Jawaharlal Nehru Fellow from 1968 to 70. He was Commonwealth Visiting Professor at the University of Cambridge from 78-79 and Visiting Fellow Wolfson College, Oxford, also 78-79. He held the Tinbergen Chair at the Erasmus University Rotterdam in 84 and was Visiting Professor at the London School of Economics in 1986. He was a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin in 1989-90, and also a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study in the Humanities at Edinburgh in 1991. He was a distinguished lecturer at the University of California at Berkeley in 1992. In the same year, he was elected a fellow of the British Academy, which, for your information, is one of the highest honors which a person of Professor Betey's status can have. And it's our great pleasure to inform you that Professor Betey is also a member of the Academic Council of our Institute, National Institute of Advanced Studies. His research interests are in the areas of social inequality, social justice, and sociological theory. He has published essays in comparative sociology, caste, class, power, inequality, and social change, as well as agrarian social structure. He has to his credit 11 books and several publications. His two most recent publications are Society and Policies in India, published in 1991, and The Backward Classes in Contemporary India, published in 1992. May I now invite Professor Betey to speak?
I'm going to give a set of four lectures dealing with Indian society, its structure, and the changes taking place in it. Now, obviously, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to deal with all aspects of this very large and very complex society in the course of four lectures. So one has to be selective. And on previous occasions, I've tried out various themes, and sometimes it has worked, sometimes it hasn't worked very well. One can never know in advance what is going to work because one doesn't really know the nature of the audience that one is addressing. It's not a group of students whom one lectures to over a period of 6 months or a year or 2 years, and one can gradually get to know one's audience and then decide how to work out one's program of lectures. I have this time decided on a considerable departure from my past practice, where I was inclined to focus generally on a particular theme, namely the theme of social inequality, and examine various aspects of it. I've decided this time to try out something somewhat different, and I've decided to talk to you on certain important aspects of Indian society. I believe they are extremely important aspects of Indian society, but not in an absolutely integrated manner. I will take up particular topics. I know that they are related to each other, but I will not worry terribly about the exact nature of the relationship among the topics which I shall discuss with you. That might come out in the course of the discussion. From past experience, once again, I have found that the most interesting part of these sessions is not the lecture that I give, but the discussion that follows. Now, what I propose to do in the course of these four lectures is to talk about tribe and caste in the course of the first two lectures. I'll talk mainly about tribes in Indian society today, and tomorrow I will talk mainly about castes. The day after tomorrow, I mean, tribe and caste are closely related to each other as themes and as features of Indian society, and this I will explain presently. Then on the third day, I will say something about class. And once again, just as caste can be seen in relation to tribe, so from another point of view, caste can also be seen in relation to class. So in that sense, caste is the centerpiece, beginning with tribe at one extreme and carrying over onto a discussion of classes at the other. So tribe, caste, class. The last lecture, perhaps rashly, I have decided to devote to the important theme of secularism. This is not altogether closely related to the first three topics, but nor is it altogether unrelated to them. Anyway, I'm not going to try to present to you my arguments about secularism as following naturally from a discussion of tribe, caste, and class, but I'm going to try to present them to you on the belief that it is a very important part of our consciousness in contemporary Indian society. It has become a very important part of public debate today because I think for the first time since independence, for the first time, there are people who are now prepared to argue publicly against secularism. And I think that this is, in a sense, a good thing, because a lot of things come out on the surface when people are prepared to put their cards on the table. So I would like to take that up in my last lecture and discuss the nature and significance of secularism in our contemporary society. But that will come at the end, not at the beginning. Today, I'm going to start by emphasizing the predominance, or at least the great significance, of groups as against individuals in the structure of traditional Indian society. A structure of society that still continues to be very important until present times. Groups rather than individuals, and I will explain in what sense one can visualize the social landscape of India primarily in terms of a large array of tribes, castes, and communities of various kinds. They do occupy a very significant space in our social landscape, even in contemporary India, and they occupied a predominant place in our social landscape in traditional Indian society. So I would like to say something about these groups, particularly groups that we describe as tribes on the one hand and castes on the other. I would like to stress the general importance of groups in our society. I mean, their importance, their general importance, has been noted by many, many people. I mean, Jawaharlal Nehru, when he wrote The Discovery of India, at a very crucial stage when he's discussing the structure of Indian society, he mentions that in our society, the individual has not counted for very much. It is the group, joint family, caste, community, that has been all important. When the individual wanted to become important in our traditional society, he became a sannyasi. He had to become a renouncer. It was only in that way that he asserted his importance as an individual, as a person. But by and large, as far as the structure of society was concerned, it was largely the group that prevailed. I think this perception of Indian society is, on the whole, a reasonably correct one, and it's a perception that has been held by many people. But I would like to insist here that this is not the only thing that there is to Indian society. And lest we forget the importance of other aspects of this society, I would also like to discuss the nature and significance of classes in our society in my third lecture. But for the time being, I'm going to remain with that perspective of our society which gives predominance to groups of different kinds in our social landscape. And this perspective has been reasserted very strongly recently by a massive project sponsored by the government of India and undertaken by the Anthropological Survey of India. This is a project known as the People of India Project, a People of India Project which was the brainchild of the then Director General of the Anthropological Survey of India, a member of the Indian Administrative Service, to which service I understand some of you belong. Dr. Suresh Singh planned over a long period of time a massive project called the People of India Project. The objective of that project was to do a kind of exhausting social mapping of contemporary India to identify, to describe, to place in their proper settings all the different groups, tribes, castes, communities that exist in this society. The first volume has in fact been... I hope this will come up in the course of the discussion. I myself viewed this entire project, despite my great respect for Dr. Singh and the Anthropological Survey of India, I myself viewed this project with some misgiving, but that is perhaps something that we can discuss later on. The first volume, the introductory volume, there are going to be several volumes, I believe more than 50 volumes or so. The first volume has already been published. And in that volume, we are told that the project has identified 4,599 distinct communities in this country. Some of these, even at a fairly superficial reading, are bogus identifications. But that is neither here nor there. I think that we have to accept the fact that a very large number of groups of this kind exist in Indian society. They are not only there, they are very much a part of the consciousness of the Indian people. And these groups are of many different kinds. Now this project, the People of India project, to which I have referred just now, I must insist, is not the first of its kind. It's certainly the most ambitious of its kind, the largest in scale, but it is by no means the first of its kind. In fact, this kind of project was set in motion by the colonial government in India towards the end of the 19th century. You will realize that towards the end of the 19th century, from 1872 onwards, but more particularly from 1881 and 1891 onwards, the colonial government developed an elaborate and an extremely impressive census apparatus. And that the objective of that census apparatus was not merely to count the number of people in the country, but also to group them together and to classify them in ways that would be intelligible and useful to those who were to govern the country. That was a very important part of the census operations. And the People of India project of today is in a sense a successor to earlier projects. And in fact, one of the most crucial, one of the most important persons who set in motion this kind of activity towards the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century was a British civil servant, Sir H.H. Risley, who in fact wrote a book called The People of India, which is in a sense a model for this kind of project. So I want to stress this fact that the British did develop a very impressive census apparatus in this country, a very, very impressive census apparatus in this country. And I was once discussing this just with a man called John Hainel, who is an economic historian and an econometrician in the London School of Economics. And I said to him just casually that it's rather odd that the British, in fact, developed a much more perfect census apparatus in India before they developed their own census apparatus. And he corrected me and he said there's nothing odd about that. There's nothing odd about that because if you look at the Tsarist Empire in Russia, you will find exactly the same thing. The Tsarist Empire in Russia developed their census apparatus more elaborately in the outlying areas. Because you need to know outlying people whose affairs you have to administer. It's a part of a knowledge which becomes useful political and administrative practice. And that is why they were so eager to have a complete social map of this country. And as it turned out, they gradually came to the conclusion that the best way of having a reliable social map of India would be to identify all the different tribes and castes in the different parts of the country. All the different tribes and castes. Because this is what, in their view, what gave to Indian society its distinctive characteristics. So, from the beginning of the present century onwards, for several decades, you have these massive compendia prepared by the British civil servants, mainly the British civil servants. Sometimes they had Indian collaborators as well, which gives you descriptions, fairly exhaustive, and they are still very, very good descriptions, I can tell you. And they were called Tribes and Castes volumes, and they were in several volumes. You have Risley's own, apart from his The People of India, he also compiled The Tribes and Castes of Bengal in two volumes. Then you have Thurston and Rangachari, The Tribes and Castes of South India. Then you have Enthoven, The Tribes in Thurston and Rangachari, I think, are in seven volumes. Then you have Enthoven's The Tribes and Castes of Bombay Presidency, then for North India, and so on and so forth. This is a part of an ongoing enterprise to try to understand Indian society in terms of the distribution of tribes and castes in it. Now, one of the things that strikes a later reader of these accounts, beginning from the end of the 19th century, and particularly thick in the first two decades of the present century, when all these different volumes, these compendia on tribes and castes, were published. And by the way, these accounts of tribes and castes also found their way into the district gazetteers. You know, the British produced a very impressive body of work, the district gazetteers, and the district gazetteers drew heavily from the tribes and castes volumes to give you an idea of the social landscape. Now, one of the things that strikes me about these, I mean, as a professional social anthropologist, professional sociologist, when I read these volumes, whether Risley's general book, The People of India, or the various books entitled Tribes and Castes of South India, of Central India, of Western India, and so on and so forth, one of the things that had always struck me, even from my student days, was the fact that these people, who were quite acute observers and had a great curiosity and were really very, very competent persons, nevertheless had great difficulty in distinguishing between tribe and caste. They had great difficulty in distinguishing between tribe and caste. And if you read them closely, you will find that very often they refer to groups that we today would describe as castes, that in Kumar Suresh Singh's compendium, I'm sure I haven't read it in detail, in Kumar Suresh Singh's compendium would quite clearly be described as castes, are very often described as tribes by these people. They knew them well. It's not as if this was done by a slip of the pen. The Jats, for instance, are frequently described as a tribe. The Ahirs, for instance, are frequently described as a tribe. And sometimes what we now call tribes are also described as castes. So there is this peculiar ambiguity, this peculiar ambivalence as to, because they saw that in one sense, morphologically, anatomically, these groups had very similar characteristics. These groups were such that membership was by birth, that they had clear boundaries and outlines, they had a distinct sense of their own identity, yet they were different. They were different in a very important sense, of course. Because if you just took a caste out of its context and saw it only as a caste and compared it with a tribe, then you would be struck by the similarities. However, you could not get a proper understanding of a caste by taking it out of its context. In order to get a proper understanding of caste, you would have to see it as one bit in a much larger jigsaw puzzle which had many other bits as well. So that is what was distinctive of caste, that it was not something autonomous. It was not something self-contained. It was something which had a place in a much larger scheme in which other such units also had their own places. And this scheme was by and large a hierarchical scheme. It was a hierarchical scheme. It was a scheme in which different pieces not only fitted together, but were ranked as high, middle, and low. Whereas when you looked at the tribal end, you were struck, of course, by the opposite, not hierarchy, but relative equality. Because these pieces, the different tribes, they were not fitted into a larger hierarchical whole. Each had a kind of autonomy, a kind of self-sufficiency, a kind of independence, which was not there in the case of castes. Nevertheless, at one level, there was a similarity between the two. And I think one of the most interesting processes in Indian society that has been going on for at least 2,000 years has been the transformation of tribes into castes. This was still going on in the 19th century when the British began to make these investigations. Castes were tribes were becoming castes. That I will take up presently. But even so, despite all these complexities, despite the fact that it is not always easy, it was never always easy for the civil servants who were making up these lists and making up their classifications to say unequivocally, when presented with a particular group, whether that group should be placed along with the tribes or along with the castes. And if you look at our lists of the scheduled tribes and the scheduled castes, you will at once be struck by this fact, that there are some groups which are put in the list of scheduled tribes that might in another state be put in the list of scheduled castes. The ambiguity is there, which is not to say, of course, that everything is ambiguous. Nobody is going to describe the Brahmins or the Banyas or the castes as a tribe, nor is anyone going to describe the Juang or the Birhor or the Aos or the Khasis as a caste. Well, in the case of the Khasis, it's a little more complicated. But, you know, I'm just pointing out the haziness, the ambiguity that one encounters on the borderline. I'm not saying that there is no difference, therefore, between tribe and caste. Of course, there's a difference. But that difference is not a very clear-cut difference, and that difference is not of such a kind as to have successfully prevented, in the past, tribes from becoming castes. So let me repeat what I believe to be the most important and the most significant difference between tribe and caste. A tribe is relatively autonomous, self-sufficient in its ideal picture. Relatively autonomous, relatively self-sufficient, relatively homogeneous, undifferentiated, unstratified, a world on its own, so to say. It is, as the anthropologists would put it, a complete society. Whereas a caste is never, by definition, it cannot be a complete society. It is a part of a much larger division of labor and a much larger hierarchical arrangement. So this is, I would say, the defining feature of the tribe as a unit, which comes out when you consider a tribe not in comparison with an individual caste, but when you compare a tribe with the caste system as a whole. Then you see the difference in the scale, then you see the fact that one is hierarchical and the other is egalitarian, the one is very heterogeneous, differentiated, the other is homogeneous and undifferentiated. But of course, this is not to say that all tribes in India are of the same kind. They're not. They're very different, very, very different from each other. And this is a fact that needs to be stressed, and I would like to stress this with the maximum force possible. I have annoyed many people, including tribal intellectuals, by saying that the idea that there is in fact such a category as the tribal people, which includes Aos, Semas, Rengmas, Mishmis, Khasis, Mundas, Uraons, Todas, Bhils, all together, is in fact a byproduct of the modern state. The sense of community between all these different groups could not possibly have existed before the emergence of the modern state. Because Aos, Khasis, Semas, compared with Uraons, Mundas, Todas, Bhils, had completely separate identities and separate experiences and separate existences. It is modern politics that has created among them a sense of their own identity and their own unity. But that I will come to as I go along. For the time being, I would like to stress this fact that the tribes are a very diverse lot. I'm now leaving behind the larger society and concentrating, focusing on our tribal population. And paradoxically enough, we have better demographic data on the tribes than on the castes, for the simple reason that after independence, it was decided not to enumerate caste in our decennial censuses, with the exception of the scheduled castes. So we cannot give exact numbers for the different castes in Indian society, whereas we can for the different tribes, or at least we could until very recently. Disaggregated figures are not easily available, but we have exact figures for each of the tribes, and we have exact figures for the population known as a whole as the scheduled tribes, which we do not have in the case of a caste. Now, there's something interesting when you look just at the demography. There's something very interesting about this demography, and I'll draw your attention to it presently. It's, you know, in relative terms, the tribal population is not a very large proportion of the Indian population. Below 8%, around 7.75% of the total population is listed as scheduled tribes. But that still adds up to today to well over 50 million persons. And 50 million persons would be the size of an average-sized European country, so that we are, in fact, dealing with a fairly large population. The point I want to make is that although it is 7.76% of the total population, this proportion has been increasing rather than decreasing. If you look at the proportion of the tribal population in the 1951 census, it is around 5.6% of the total population. And then there came a big jump in 1981. And from 5.6 to 7.76 is a fairly big increase. What has been this due to? Have the tribal populations been reproducing at a faster rate? Is the natural rate of reproduction much higher in the tribal population than in the non-tribal population? No. That is not the reason why there has been a big jump. The reason why there has been a big jump is that several groups that were not included in the list of scheduled tribes was included in that list after 1976. So, there has been an inflation of the tribal population because new groups have been added on. And therefore, from the historical point of view, we are faced with a very paradoxical situation. And what is that paradox? The paradox is the following, that it is a truism among students of social change, social evolution, that with progress and modernization, tribal formations are replaced by more advanced, more complex social formations. When you live by hunting and gathering, the entire community is tribal. When you move from that to shifting cultivation, still the tribal component predominates. When you move from that to settled agriculture, then gradually other types of social formations emerge, and the tribal formation tends to recede demographically in terms of numbers. And then you have industrialization, which does away with tribal formations. Now, there can be no doubt whatsoever that there has been some material progress in India since independence. There has been some urbanization, some industrialization. How is it that despite this urbanization and industrialization, the tribal population, instead of going down, has in fact increased? Well, I think the answer to that lies in the domain of politics. A tribe or a scheduled tribe is simply what the government of India decides to describe as a scheduled tribe. That's all that there is to it. If certain groups are categorized as scheduled tribes, then we count them as scheduled tribes. These different groups are in fact undergoing precisely the kinds of changes in their social and economic life that one would expect in the normal course to come about as a result of urbanization, industrialization, and so on and so forth. But they have found some specific advantages in insisting that they should continue to be designated as tribes, and new groups are in search of the same advantages and would like today to be designated as tribes, whereas 40 or 50 years ago, they would rather not be designated as tribes. In fact, Kumar Suresh Singh himself has drawn attention to a number of such cases in Bihar, in the state of Bihar, in the 20s and 30s and so on. There were groups which the then British administration had called tribes. They were called Aboriginal tribes. And the leaders of these groups had protested and said that we are not tribes. We are not tribes. Why are you calling us tribes? Same thing with the exterior castes or the scheduled castes. There were groups which in fact had protested and wanted their names to be taken out from the list of scheduled castes. This was before 1947. After 1947,
the trend has been in reverse, and new groups want to be now included and to be redesignated as tribes. So this is one important reason. Now this, of course, is not to say that all of this is a fiction, that all the groups that are designated as scheduled tribes are of this kind. In fact, the majority of them do have most of the characteristics: relative smallness of scale, relative homogeneity, lack of differentiation, lack of stratification that we would associate with the character of being a tribal community. But there are others who, despite changes or despite having moved away from those characteristics, would now like to be designated as tribes and remain designated as tribes. Now, I said that today there are over 50 million persons, and today they comprise nearly 8% of the population. But once we disaggregate these figures, once we look at the individual tribes, of course, we find that they are many and diverse, and they are very different from each other. I'll give you some idea of the differences, but in pure demographic terms, the differences are very impressive, because there are some tribes which are very small indeed, a few hundred families or a few thousand families, whereas there are other tribes, like the Santal, for instance, in Bihar mainly, like the Bhils, for instance, in western India, like the Gonds in central India, who number more than 3 million persons. And you know, if you take just the Santals or the Bhils or the Gonds, they would compare with the population of a country like Finland. You see, they're very large, and therefore there is something somewhat paradoxical about continuing to designate them as tribes. Because a group that is so large in size, that is so scattered and dispersed, Santals in several states in India, is almost certain to have developed the kind of social differentiation, the kind of social stratification that are the opposite of the characteristics that we attribute to tribal communities. Now, in terms of their distribution, of course, until the end of the last century, the people whom we designate as tribes, they had certain very distinctive features in terms of their distribution. And this is one important difference between the scheduled tribes and the scheduled castes. The scheduled tribes were not homogeneously or uniformly distributed throughout the country. And I think that if we look at their distribution, if we think of their distribution, we will be able to understand some of the distinctive social characteristics of these tribal people. What was the nature of their distribution? They were distributed by and large in the interior hill and forest areas of the country, or on the frontiers of the country. In other words, they were to be found in the relatively isolated and inaccessible ecological niches. And one might in fact argue that it is precisely those populations, those communities that were isolated in inaccessible and inhospitable hill and forest areas that developed and continued in ways of life that we would expect to be associated with the tribe in the proper sense of the term. But again, these tribal niches, these inaccessible hill and forest areas, are not all found in one single part of the country. I think that there is a considerable difference between the tribal habitat in inner India, particularly in Chota Nagpur in Madhya Pradesh, as compared to the tribal habitat on the frontiers in areas like Mizoram, Arunachal, Nagaland, and so on. There are considerable differences. The only thing that I would like to stress at this point is that numerically, demographically, the overwhelming majority of our tribal population is found not on the frontiers, but in the interior areas. And all the really massive tribes, the tribes which are very large in size, like the Santals, the Bhils, the Oraons, the Gonds, they're all in the interior. The frontier tribes, you don't find any really large tribe numbering a million persons. You don't find tribes on that scale in the frontier areas at all. And in fact, their pattern of life, their forms of social organization, have been rather different from the pattern of life and forms of social organization that are characteristic of the tribal groups in the interior of the country. So once again, we come back to the question as to what actually is the nature of the social and cultural unity of that section of the population that we today characterize as the scheduled tribes. Let us examine very briefly what are the distinctive features, if any, of these tribal populations. First, let us look at race. A great deal of the thinking about the tribal people, even today, is a legacy of the thinking about the tribal people from the end of the 19th century onwards. And this is only to be expected, because those civil servants and those who wrote on the tribal population were in fact very perceptive observers of Indian society, and what they described and recorded has naturally influenced our own perceptions today, as is very evident from the very conception of the project, the people of India, when we look back on earlier projects. Now, if we look at what influenced those people, people like Risley, people like Nesfield, people later on like Hutton, then it's obvious that they in turn, they were very well-read persons. Many of them were outstanding scholars. And they in turn were greatly influenced by what they read on the tribes in other parts of the world, especially the work of the outstanding anthropologists dealing with tribes in North America, dealing with tribes on the South Seas, dealing with tribes in Australia, dealing with tribes in Melanesia. And one of the things that repeatedly come up in these discussions, general anthropological discussions, is that, of course, the tribes are racially different from the non-tribal population. This is indeed true if you look at Australia. This is indeed true if you look at North America. The American Indians are racially quite different from the non-tribal population. In Canada, the tribal population is quite distinct from the non-tribal population. But when you look at India, the picture is very much more complex. Very much more complex because, first of all, you cannot say that the tribal population as a whole shows a set of distinctive racial biological characteristics. This would be completely false. The tribes in the Northeast are biologically, physically, in their appearance, in their genetic composition, quite different from the tribes in Chota Nagpur or in Bastar. And secondly, the biological, the physical differences between the tribal and the non-tribal population in any given area, particularly in the interior, is not very sharp. You have made all kinds of studies have been made, data have been collected by physical anthropologists in Chota Nagpur, in Bihar, for instance, in Madhya Pradesh, for instance, which shows that there is no sharp line of division by which we can clearly, on purely racial or biological grounds, say that these are the biological characteristics of the tribal population of Bihar and these are the biological characteristics of the non-tribal population of Bihar. Not at all. In fact, if there are differences, then these differences are very gradual, and you move from slow gradation from the tribal population to the population of the lower castes until you reach the highest castes. The burden of my story is a very simple one, that in biological terms, in racial terms, in purely physical terms, the tribal population of Chota Nagpur has much more similarity with the non-tribal population of Chota Nagpur than it has with the tribal population of the Northeast. This is something that has to be kept in mind. Once again, when we are considering the unity of the tribal population or the indigenous people as a whole. What about religion? I think, you know, I must add this, that for several decades the British were quite puzzled by this fact, because their reading of the anthropological literature, which was being produced in North America, Australia, and other parts of the world, had led them to expect that racially the tribal population would be different from the non-tribal population. So they were quite puzzled by this. But gradually, I think we've come to learn that there have been all kinds of intermixtures over a very long period of time, which makes it extremely difficult to make any such conclusion categorically. What about religion? That, again, was something which the colonial administrators and the anthropologists among them caught on to. I think by the 30s, roughly speaking, their view was that you could make a distinction between tribal and non-tribal on the basis of religion. And that belief, I think, is completely mistaken. And their argument was that the tribal population were animists. They worshipped nature, trees, plants, rocks, rivers, whereas the non-tribal population were Hindus. So if you were sufficiently painstaking in collecting information about religious practices, then you would be able to label some groups as animists, and you could say that they're tribals, and other groups as Hindus, and you could say that these are castes. So that they felt was a rule of thumb for distinguishing between tribe and caste. If they were Hindus, if a group had basically Hindu practices, then it was a caste. If it had basically animistic practices, then it was a tribe. This is mistaken and misleading, because for two reasons. There are numerous Hindu religious practices that have not only over the decades, not only over the centuries, but practically over the millennia, penetrated into the religious beliefs and practices of the tribal population. And the first person to draw attention to this pointedly and to overwhelm one of the great enthusiasts for the autonomy and the distinctiveness of the Indian tribal population was a man called Verrier Elwin. He was an Englishman, very noble-hearted Englishman, who came out to India to do a Christian missionary work. And then he came under the influence of Mahatma Gandhi and became a Gandhian and decided to devote his life to the study and the welfare of the tribal population. Now, he was someone, and he had the years after independence of Mr. Nehru. If there was anybody in India who had the years of Mr. Nehru on tribal questions, it was Verrier Elwin. Verrier Elwin, along with many others, mainly British colonial administrators, took the view that the tribal people were quite distinct and different from the non-tribal people. They were animists, the others were Hindus. And this was challenged in a very impressive study by a man called G.S. Ghurye, who was the professor of sociology in Bombay University, doyen of Indian sociologists. I don't know if you will have the opportunity of listening to Professor M.N. Srinivas, who is our most important, most distinguished living sociologist. Professor Srinivas was Ghurye's student. Ghurye wrote a book called The Aborigines So-Called, in which he took up this argument and tore it to shreds, showing that the tribal people, in fact, had these Hindu elements of belief and practice had penetrated so deeply into the tribal world that it was impossible to say that they are animists and therefore they are tribal. Let me give you one example. This is not Ghurye's example. This example, which was a favorite one with my teacher, the late Professor N.K. Bose, who was himself also a Gandhian, Nirmal Kumar Bose. Bose did his fieldwork among the Juang, who are a very remote hill tribe in Orissa. And he said that when he went there in the late 1920s, these tribes, they generally offer blood sacrifices, usually chickens. They sacrifice chickens and so on. And he was prepared for this because he'd read in the books that this is what it was. But he found that they had a peculiar ceremony, according to which on a particular day, they took offerings of fruits on sal leaf cups and put them on the river bank. And that was the ceremony. And so he was very puzzled by this. And so he asked him, why do you do this? What does all this mean? And they said, we don't know why we do it, but we have done it from time immemorial. They used to say that some great sadhu, some great sant had passed along this route and he had lived with us and he had blessed us, and it is for him that we do this. Now N.K. Bose traced back the wanderings of Sri Chaitanya, the great medieval Vaishnava saint. And you know, in Chaitanya's life, he was a great Sanskrit pandit. And in midlife, he decided that panditry was not the best way of reaching God. God could be reached more easily through devotion. And so he decided to renounce all that and to go and live in Puri. But his heart was not in Puri. His heart was in Vrindavan. And so he would go on pilgrimage from Puri to Vrindavan by the traditional route. And the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which was compiled by his devotees, has a long section which records that once the Lord decided that this time I am not going to go to Vrindavan through the usual route, this time I will go to Vrindavan through the forest route. And then the Charitamrita describes Chaitanya's journey through the forest route and how these wild hill people came out to receive him and so on and so forth. So this kind of thing has been going on in this society for such a long time that it becomes extremely difficult to argue that the religion of the tribals is clearly animism. On the other hand, it becomes equally difficult to say that Hinduism itself is completely different from animism. There are innumerable practices associated with perfectly good Hindu castes, which would be recognized as Hindu castes, which can be characterized as animistic practices. So religion, in my judgment, does not provide a decisive test for distinguishing tribe from caste. What does then? In the middle of the 19th century, there were several populations of relatively small communities isolated in inaccessible hill and forest areas where they continued to live according to their own modes of life. It is very likely that they will have retained their own indigenous languages and dialects. And these languages and dialects, in fact, have served as markers for tribal as against caste communities over the ages. And in fact, you find in India, apart from the principal languages listed in our constitution and listed on each one of our banknotes, there are now about 17 or 18 of them, in addition to these literary languages like Bengali, Marathi, Tamil, and so on and so forth, there is a very large number, running into about 400 different languages, each associated with one of these communities. So language, I would say, is probably the best test, but not an invariable test. Because as it happens, yes, prefer. I think there's a lot of dispute among anthropologists on whether one should use the term language only to refer to literary languages, confining the use of the word dialect to languages which are not literary languages. In the past, these non-literary languages like Mundari, like Ho, like Gondi, the practice was to call them dialects. But today, I think the general practice is to call all of them Bengali, Tamil, Hindi, Toda, Ho, Santali, Mundari, Kuruk, to call all of them languages. I think that's the general practice today. Of course, we can still distinguish between literary languages and non-literary languages. As I say, whether you call it language and dialect or literary language and non-literary language, even that is not a perfectly good test, because we know that there are several tribes, including some very large tribes, which do not have any distinctive language of their own, but speak the language of the region. This is particularly common for reasons that I don't really have an explanation for. They are particularly common in some regions in the country. In Western India, the Bhils, for instance, one of the largest tribes, do not have a distinctive language of their own. And there are other tribes like the Dublas, for instance, Gujarat. They do not speak a distinctive language of their own. They speak the local version of Gujarati. The problem with dialect is, of course, Bengali has many different dialects. And Gujarati has, I presume, I know Bengali, so I can say it has many different dialects. Some of which, at least in their spoken form, are mutually incomprehensible to each other. I mean, I wouldn't be able to understand easily the Bengali spoken in Chittagong or the Bengali spoken in Sylhet. So now there are large tribal groups, particularly in Western India and in Southern India, which do not have and have not had for centuries any distinctive language of their own. And moreover, many of the tribal groups that did have distinctive languages of their own have in fact been rapidly giving up their languages and taking up some kind of a, in Bihar, in Chotanagpur, it's called Sadhani, some kind of a sort of bazaar language, lingua franca, which they use. So I think language still continues, language or the memory of language or the tradition of a distinctive language or dialect, if you prefer to use that term, still continues to be a sort of differentiating feature of tribal communities in the vast majority of cases, although it's not an absolutely foolproof test for every particular tribe. Finally, the one thing that is very important from the point of view of practical policy, of course, is mode of livelihood. The mode of livelihood of the tribal people traditionally has been different from the mode of livelihood of the non-tribal people. There are different modes of... I mean, I'm now going back to the middle of the 19th century and right till the time of independence, although changes have been rapidly taking place since independence and even in the 100 years up to the time of independence. First of all, you had tribal groups, usually very small, very, very isolated, who lived by hunting and gathering. They did not have a technology of food production. They lived mainly by hunting and gathering. Very well-known example of that would be the Birhor in Chotanagpur. Then some of the hill khadiyas lived by hunting and gathering. You have some tribes in Kerala who live by hunting and gathering. So you do have, or you did have, until recent times, a small number of tribes, and usually they're very small. They accounted for a very small proportion of the total tribal population. Outside the mainland of India, of course, the classic site of tribal groups which lived by hunting and gathering was the Andaman Islands, the Andamanese tribes. They were quite different racially, linguistically. I said that there is no clear racial distinction between tribal and non-tribal population, but the only exception, there is an exception, the only exception is the case of the indigenous population of the Andaman Islands. They are very, very different racially, linguistically, and in their religion, because they were completely isolated and cut off, unlike the other people. Hunting and gathering has gradually been receding, it's dying out. Then, of course, you also had tribes that lived by shifting cultivation, which is a rather technologically backward form of agriculture. You cut down the mountain slopes, set fire to them, and plant something. Don't use the plow, don't use any livestock for it, just scatter the seeds broadcast. And because of this rather slapdash method, the fertility of the soil is exhausted very quickly, so you move to another plot, and then you move to another plot, and then to another plot, and after 10 or 15 years come back to the original plot, which by then will have recovered its fertility. This is shifting cultivation, economically not terribly efficient, and there were many tribes which in the past lived by shifting cultivation. Some of them are very well known, including some that have been described in very vivid and moving detail by Verir Elvin himself, the Sauras of Orissa, the Bondo Highlanders of Orissa, and the Baigars of Central India. Elwin's first famous book was on the Baigars and the suffering that had been caused to them by the policy of the government to prevent them from continuing with shifting cultivation and to move on to settled plow cultivation. Then, of course, you also had tribes which lived by pastoralism, by animal husbandry, few of them, like the Todas, for instance, very famous example from the Nilgiri Hills. But the overwhelming majority of the tribes, and particularly the larger tribes, Santal, Munda, Urao, Ho, Bhil, Gond, they lived by plough cultivation. But even that plough cultivation, the technology used in it was not as advanced, as complex, as sophisticated as the technology used by the non-tribal population. And in any case, it was not integrated into the kind of elaborate division of labor involving a whole range of crafts, specialized crafts, services, and so on that you find among the non-tribal population. As a result, when we consider the tribal population as a whole, we find that in two very important respects, they are backward. And this, I believe, has been largely because of their isolation in hill and forest areas. They have been economically backward, partly because of their isolation, no trade, and partly because they did not always live in those habitats by choice. They were often pushed into those habitats, which were, from the point of view of production, the least satisfactory habitats, the hill slopes and so on. So they remain economically backward, and they are also educationally backward because they did not have access to the various kinds of facilities that became increasingly available from the middle of the 19th century onwards to the non-tribal population. All along, I have emphasized one fact, and that is the permeability of the boundary between the tribal and the non-tribal population. It is not a rigid, fixed boundary ever in the past. In the past, we have plenty of evidences of groups, let's say, practicing shifting cultivation, small group practicing shifting cultivation. The carrying capacity of the land when you are dependent on shifting cultivation is rather precarious. And when the pressure of population mounts on the land, then groups of people move away, come down the hill slopes, and try to get themselves first economically integrated into the more complex and the more efficient economy of the non-tribal population in the plains villages, either as agricultural laborers or as dealers in forest products like honey, lac, basketry, ropes, and so on. And the traditional practice has been to accept such people and their services. Gradually, they come down, and from sporadic exchanges, you have a more or less fixed pattern of exchange and colonies of these people. I've myself seen colonies of Santals settling down in villages in Bankura district, in Birbhum district, in Burdwan. They settle down. And, you know, we have records of this kind of thing going back to the 19th century and before. And they are usually accepted as a part of the village. And they are given a certain place in it and a certain economic security on the condition that they occupy the lowest rung of the social ladder. That's the price for security that has generally been demanded. Now then, they are not required to give up all their traditional customs and practices. No, because this society, even the non-tribal society, has accommodated, since time immemorial, all varieties of customs and practices. In fact, the tolerance of diversity, even the encouragement of diversity, was very much a part of the ideology of Hinduism, unlike the ideology of some of the Semitic religions, which required a much more standardized conformity to standardized practices. So they were allowed. Certain things, of course, had to be given up, like beef eating and things of that kind. They gradually came to absorb Hindu gods, Hindu ritual practices, and over several generations, they adopted the languages of the communities in which they lived. But they always lived as a group and maintained some of their traditional practices and conventions. But when they dropped some of the other conventions and practices, when they adopted some of the religious practices of the non-tribal population among whom they had come to live, and when they abandoned their language, then the group had transformed itself from a tribe into a caste. And this is what Bose has described as the Hindu method of tribal absorption. And this has been going on for a very, very long period of time. I think what has been different in Indian civilization as compared, I mean, after all, even in Europe, there must have been a time. I mean, we know from the accounts of Caesar in Gaul, we know from the accounts of Tacitus in Germany, that Germany, the population of Germany was predominantly tribal. The population of Gaul was predominantly tribal. And this would be true anywhere in the world. And the tribal population was gradually absorbed into the more expanding, the economically more advanced non-tribal civilization. Whereas in the other parts of the world, no traces remained of their collective identities as this tribe or that tribe or some other tribe. Here, they were absorbed while being allowed to retain their traditional collective identity, some memory of it. They remained an in-marrying group. They continued to be endogamous. That didn't matter because all castes were endogamous. So this is the way in which the tribal population has been gradually absorbed and tribes have been gradually transformed into castes. It is this process that has now been arrested, oddly enough, at precisely the point of time when we would have expected this process to become hastened up. Because after all, the country is opening up. All kinds of things are happening. There's urbanization, industrialization, railways, air transport, all sorts of things are happening. So we would have expected this process to hasten up. As a matter of fact, what has happened is to some extent the opposite. I'm not saying that in other respects they haven't hastened up, but the identity of the tribal group as a tribal group has now acquired a political value. As a result, I do not see any longer, at least in the foreseeable future, the possibility of tribes becoming transformed into castes. Because now it has been realized that to be a tribe, to remain a tribe, gives one politically a certain advantage, a certain bargaining power. So that the point I would like to conclude with is that a process that had been going on normally and naturally in this society for at least 2,000 years, and which we might have expected to have become hastened, has in fact in a peculiar way been reversed as a result of a certain kind of politics that has taken hold of our society in the last 40, 50 years. This is, I believe, something unanticipated. I don't think that when I was an undergraduate student of anthropology in the University of Calcutta in the 50s, my teachers really expected that this was what was going to. We were taught something quite different. And they were very intelligent people, I can tell you. Some of them were very intelligent people. They didn't expect this. They had expected something different. Now, it is not as if that what they had expected did not happen at all. That also is happening, I can tell you. Tribal populations are becoming more and more differentiated internally. At the same time, there is also a strong sense of collective identity. And this is something that I believe is going to stay with us at least for one generation, at least in my lifetime. I don't expect this trend to be once again reversed and tribal identities disappear in the way in which at least teachers, the generation of my teachers had expected that they would have been effaced and attenuated. Well, I think I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Yesterday I spoke to you mainly about tribes, but I tried to place my discussion of tribes in the context of the larger significance of groups or collective identities as against individuals in traditional Indian society. Even while talking about the tribe, I had to make references to caste in order to draw your attention to similarities and differences between the tribe as a unit of social morphology and the caste, both as a unit of social morphology and as a system of such units. And today, I'm going to talk about the caste system, taking into account not just these units, which one can compare with tribes, but the system as a whole. Caste, of course, is much more central to the structure and morphology of Indian society than tribe. And indeed, for many people, it is caste that constitutes or constituted the basic structure of traditional Indian society, particularly traditional Hindu society. And many sociologists, anthropologists, and others have argued that in order to understand the distinctive features, both in terms of collective identities and in terms of the tremendous preoccupation with hierarchy in Indian society, even until present times, the key to that understanding really lies in our understanding of the caste system. Now, several questions arise at once. The first question, which I'm sure will occur to many of you, and to which I'm afraid I do not have any very clear or definite answer, and therefore I'm not going to discuss it in my exposition, although you are free to raise the question. The first question that arises to many people is, how did all this originate? How did the caste system come into existence in India? What were the specific circumstances that led to the origins of caste in India and not in other societies or civilizations? I'm not going to discuss this question at all. A related question, I think, deals with what may be called the singularity of the system. That is the caste system as we have actually known it in our lives, or as was known in their lives by our predecessors who have left reasonably accurate contemporary record of the system, is the caste system as it has been actually known to us in the present century and in the 19th century, is it absolutely unique to India? Or do we find variants of it in other societies as well? Let me say at once that the experts are very sharply divided on this question. There are those who are inclined to argue that caste is only a very extreme form of a kind of social morphology which we do encounter in other societies. And therefore, caste varies only in degree from other types of social systems of social stratification. That is one point of view. And these are people who tend to regard caste primarily as a system of social stratification. That is, a system in which the population is divided and subdivided into groups which are clearly separated from each other and which are ranked in a kind of hierarchy. And these scholars who regard caste as primarily a system of stratification are inclined to argue, yes, it is very elaborate, more elaborate than other such systems found in other parts of the world. Yes, it is very rigid, more rigid than other such systems found in other parts of the world. But these are only differences in degree. And very often, scholars, have compared, for instance, the caste system in India with what has been called the color caste system in the United States, particularly the division of the American population into whites and blacks. That division also was extremely rigid. That division was also characterized by very strict rules of endogamy, at least until very recent times. And so people have said that there are parallels, many parallels, between the caste system in India as it traditionally was and the color caste system in the United States. It's not that they are unaware of the differences between the two systems, but they have argued that their similarities are in some sense very fundamental and they can be compared, and these comparisons can throw light not only on the system of racial stratification in the United States, but these comparisons may also throw light on the caste system in traditional Indian society and onto the contemporary period. Then the question of South Africa also is very, very interesting. There also you have a system of apartheid and the practice of untouchability, of segregation, macro segregation, micro segregation. All of these things have been compared with the practice of untouchability in our society, the exclusion of an important section, demographically at least, of the population from the community life and so on and so forth. So there are those people who have argued that not just today when the caste system is changing, but even if we look at the caste system at the middle of the 19th century when it was more or less intact, it has many points of similarity with other systems of rigid social stratification in other parts of the world. But there are others who would argue, yes, there are similarities, but these similarities are extremely superficial. What is really important are the differences and the uniqueness of the Indian caste system. And they would argue that the uniqueness of the Indian caste system lies in the cultural elaboration of a particular ideology, of a particular way of thinking, a particular way of perceiving the world. And this way of perceiving the world with its multifarious opposition between the ideas of purity and pollution, its linkage with a major religious tradition, is something that makes the caste system quite unique. They would say that you will not be able to understand the caste system at all if you don't understand the importance of the ritual opposition between purity and pollution. And that ritual opposition between purity and pollution is very deeply embedded in Hindu ideology, and therefore it is that which makes the caste system truly unique as far as other systems of social stratification are concerned. There are systems of social stratification. Some of these systems of social stratification can be quite rigid, but they are not embedded in the kind of cultural tradition which creates ideas, beliefs, and values that permeate the whole of life. And this is what needs to be looked at if you are trying to understand the caste system. All right. If that is so, then we come to India and to the Indian subcontinent. And those who say that caste is unique and the analogy between caste in India and racial stratification in the United States or racial stratification in South Africa or other systems of rigid stratification is superficial would nevertheless agree that you do find systems which are very much alike, not simply in India, but in South Asia as a whole. They would say that caste is, in that sense, a characteristic of what they call pan-Indian civilization. Its influence, not just its social morphological influence, but its cultural influence in terms of shaping the attitudes, habits, beliefs, etc., are to be found not just in India, but in the Indian subcontinent in the wider sense of the term. You find it, they would say, yes, the ritual opposition of purity and pollution is specifically embedded in the Hindu tradition, but nevertheless, that tradition has very significantly influenced Islamic societies on the Indian subcontinent. And that's a point which has been contentious, but nevertheless, it is a point that most sociologists have come to accept. They would say that, yes, the ideology of Islam, in its purest sense, has nothing to do with caste, in the sense in which the ideology of Hinduism is deeply permeated by the opposition between purity and pollution and is therefore a very integral part of caste. The ideology of Islam as such does not have anything to do with caste, but Islam in India, Islam in Pakistan, Islam in Bangladesh has been so deeply permeated by the general ideology of Indian civilization that similar developments may be found to a very great extent in the Islamic societies, not only in Pakistan and Bangladesh, but also in India itself. You know, this became a very contentious issue as to whether caste exists among the Muslims or not. It had generally been taken for granted that caste was a distinctly Hindu phenomenon. Then these census takers that I'm talking about, when they began their mapping, the mapping of the social landscape of India, were initially, certainly in the 1891, 1901, and 1911 census, they confined their major discussions to the caste system among the Hindus. But the 1921 census report contained a large chapter on caste among the Muslims in India. And this evoked a lot of animosity. There were responses from Muslim intellectuals to the effect that, well, there may be some aberrations in Islamic society in India, there may be some similarities, but these are really accidental and not integral to the practice of Islam even in India. But later, sociologists and anthropologists in India, including Muslim sociologists and anthropologists like Ghaus Ansari and Imtiaz Ahmed and the others, have pointed out that there are indeed distinctions and rankings and gradations among Indian Muslims that are very similar to the distinctions, gradations, and rankings among the Hindus that we describe as castes. The same question has been raised about the Buddhist society in Sri Lanka. And again, the answer has been roughly the same, that you do find distinctions, gradations, rankings there, which are very similar to the distinctions, gradations, and rankings of caste. And therefore, it may not be altogether mistaken to speak of caste when we are speaking of social inequalities, of social distinctions, of gradations, ranking, not only among Hindus in India and Muslims in India, but also among Muslims in Pakistan, also among Buddhists in Sri Lanka. And this is more or less a generally accepted position among social anthropologists and sociologists. But whatever the position may be, I think everybody would agree that caste in its fullest form, in its most elaborate form, in its most complete form, and as a system that has enjoyed a tremendous amount of continuity over time, is to be found among the Hindus. And therefore, in talking about caste today, I shall talk mainly about the caste system among the Hindus. And of course, in the course of the discussion, you can raise questions about what exactly is the nature of the analog among Muslims, among Sikhs, among Buddhists that we find to the caste system. There's one particular feature of caste among the Hindus that I would like to draw your attention to. No matter what significance we assign to the distinctions, gradations, rankings of groups among the Muslims, the Sikhs, the Buddhists, one fact remains, that it is only in Hindu society that we find not only the practice of caste, it is only in Hindu society that we find not only caste as an existing part of the reality, but we also find a fully developed theory of caste. And I think that is also very important, because caste is not simply the way in which people are divided and ranked. It is also a part of an ideology which has had a very long existence in this society. That ideology has been questioned, is being questioned over and over again, has been questioned for the last 100 years. It has been rejected by our constitution. But rejecting an ideology is a little more complex than discarding it in a constitution. It is not at all clear that that ideology has been completely rooted out from the minds of men and women. So as far as that ideology is concerned, that ideology is based on a kind of social theory which has been developed in its most elaborate and in its most extreme form in traditional Hindu society. So in that sense, caste as a complete system, not only with its own practice but also with its own theory, is perhaps a unique feature of Hindu society. And what is striking about the theory of caste, and not just the practice of caste, is its enormous continuity in Hindu society. And here, I would just like to make an analogy with other societies, not now the United States or South Africa, but with medieval European society. A medieval European society was also divided into estates, just as our traditional society was divided into varnas. Medieval European society, whether in France or in Germany or in England, was also divided into estates. And there also, the division into estates, the ranking of estates, the inequality between estates was not a matter just of practice. It was also a part of medieval social theory. The system of estates was justified by a theoretical system. However, and this is what is interesting, the theory which upheld the system of estates in medieval Europe did not have anything like the elaborateness, the complexity, and the continuity of the theory of varnas by which the caste system was upheld in India. It had a continuity lasting for at least 2,000 years. You find medieval theologians, medieval writers on medieval European society developing and elaborating a theory which explains and justifies the system of estates in Europe. But that theory, that ideology, did not have anything like the complexity, the completeness, and the continuity of the theory which had been developed in the Dharmashastras and which continued for at least 2,000 years in Indian society as an official ideology among the Hindus, until it was gradually challenged by the laws introduced by the British in the 19th century and completely overthrown by the Constitution of India. So the ideology of caste has ceased to be the official ideology, is completely at odds with the official ideology. How different it is from the official ideology, you can see easily by taking the Manusmriti. And I tell my students this. It's not a very difficult exercise to perform at all. The Manusmriti is not at all a difficult book to read. There are plenty of English translations available of the Manusmriti. And it doesn't take very much time to read it. It's not a very, very long text. One should just read the Manusmriti and get some flavor of the ideological basis of traditional Hindu society and then read the Constitution of India, and one gets the flavor of a different kind of ideology. And the difference is really enormous. I mean, one is almost the opposite of the other. But I repeat once again, although the official ideology, which is embodied in the Constitution of India, is completely at odds with the ideology of the Dharma Shastra, the ideology in which the hierarchy of caste occupied a central significance, nevertheless, there are many thoughts, ideas, and beliefs that continue to exist in the minds of people independently of what the idea of official ideology establishes. Therefore, I don't think that it would be quite correct to believe that the ideology of Varna, the ideology of caste, which has been repudiated by the Constitution, has completely disappeared altogether from the minds of people in this society. Having said that, let me now try to give you a descriptive account of the principal features of the caste system, particularly among the Hindus in India, and particularly as it existed until our own times. I'm aware of the fact that the system is changing, but it has certainly not disappeared, and I do not by any means believe that it is going to disappear in our lifetime. But I will not, at this stage, try to indicate to you all the changes or the major directions of change. I want to give you an idea of the basic features of the anatomy of caste as it has existed over a long period of time. And then perhaps there may be time to discuss the ways in which changes are coming about in this basic anatomy or morphology of caste. Before I begin to give you a descriptive account of the principal features of the system, I think there's one terminological difficulty that needs to be cleared up. What do we mean by caste? Now, you see, the point is that the same English word, caste, has been used for two different, though of course closely related, Indian terms. And these are really Indian terms, not Bengali or Hindi or Punjabi or Tamil, because these terms are known in all, as far as I know, all Indian languages. One is Varna and the other is Jati. We use the word caste sometimes to mean Varna. We use the word caste at other times to mean Jati. And they are distinct. And I'm not saying that they're not related, they're closely related, but nevertheless they are distinct from each other, and I would like you to keep this distinction in mind, because very often people talk about caste as Varna and then suddenly slip into talking about caste as Jati. Or people engage in an argument about the nature of caste and talk past each other, because one person is talking mainly about caste as Varna and the other person is talking mainly about caste as Jati. For instance, the Varna scheme, Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, is completely inflexible. Whereas the Jati scheme, all the different divisions and subdivisions that actually exist on the ground, like Smartha, Sri Vaishnava, Vellala, Padayachi, so on and so forth in each particular region, that is not quite as inflexible. The ranks of the different jatis are always subject to a certain amount of ambiguity. So I may be talking with somebody and saying that caste is completely inflexible, and the other person may be saying that, no, you're mistaken, caste is not completely inflexible, there is a certain amount of caste mobility, and we may argue for a very long time and talk past each other if I mean by caste the system of Varnas and the other person means by caste the system of Jatis. What then is the distinction between Varna and Jati? Now, there are several ways of formulating the distinction between Varna and Jati, and let me say that the most popular way of viewing the distinction between Varna and Jati is also the most misleading. It is to regard the Varnas as castes and the Jatis as subcastes, as if the Varnas are large aggregates and the Jatis are subdivisions of these large aggregates. Now, this is misleading, and anybody who has tried to examine the system will find out how misleading it is. I, in fact, learned the hard way to avoid this way of seeing the relationship between Varna and Jati. If you go to an area, anywhere, let us say in a district in Karnataka or a district in West Bengal, I actually tried this out in a district in Bihar, and make a list of all the jatis. You get a census taken and you get the names of jatis and make a list of all these jatis, as I in fact did in the district of Giridih in Bihar in 1958. And then I thought, how am I going to deal with such a large number of jatis? I must group them together, I must classify them, because the kind of statistical treatment that I wanted to submit my data to would not be very satisfactorily performed if I had such a large number of units. So group them together. What could be more reasonable than to try to group them into the various varnas? And then I got a number of knowledgeable persons from the region and I gave them my lists and I told them that now you group them into varnas. And it turned out that this is quite impossible to do, because there is a tremendous amount of dispute as to whether this jati should be placed in the Vaishya Varna, that jati in the Kshatriya Varna. Some people say it belongs to the Vaishya Varna. Other people say, no, it doesn't belong to the Vaishya Varna. They are they call themselves Baniyas, but they are not really Vaishyas because they do not perform the ceremonies of the Vaishyas. Or they call themselves Thakurs, but they were actually peasants who now call themselves Rajputs. They're not really Kshatriyas. So there is an enormous amount of difficulty in viewing these jatis and their subdivisions as, in fact, straightforward subdivisions of the Varnas. There is a simple theory according to which, first there were the four Varnas. Each Varna was further divided and subdivided and sub-subdivided, and that is how we came to have the jatis. Now, this is not altogether correct, and we don't have really any very clear historical evidence about the forms or the steps through which this kind of thing may have happened. How then do we see the relation between Varna and Jati? There is, I believe, a better way of seeing the relation between Varna and Jati. And that is to regard the Varnas as a model, an ideal scheme, a plan, a blueprint of traditional Hindu society. And the jatis as the lived-in reality, the actual reality on the ground. Or in, if I may use a bit of anthropological jargon, it is better to regard the Varna as the thought-out order, as the conceptual scheme of traditional Hindu society. Those are the categories in terms of which the authors of the Dharma Shastra wanted to describe, represent Hindu society and explain the logic of Hindu society. Whereas the jatis were the actual divisions that people took into account in the choice of an occupation, in the arrangement of a marriage, and so on and so forth. Now, Manu, for instance, the author of the principal Dharma Shastra, to which Hindu law has referred back for about 2,000 years, was perfectly aware of the fact that there are the four Varnas. In addition, there were all kinds of actual subdivisions. And he, in fact, tries to explain how the one can be related to the other. But the main point is that whenever the Dharma Shastra try to explain the logic of the system, there is a, and I repeat this point, that this is what in a sense makes the Hindu caste system quite different from other systems of stratification, because there is an elaborate attempt at trying to understand this, at trying to explain it, at trying to justify it, at trying to legitimize it. And this attempt to justify, legitimize, explain, and understand the system is almost invariably done through the idiom of the Varnas. In what sense? For instance, one is explaining, as I shall presently talk about, one is explaining a very widespread practice among Hindus, and a practice that is tolerated very widely, and that is the practice of hypergamy or anuloma, practice whereby a man of a higher caste is allowed to marry a woman of a lower caste. And then what are the consequences of this kind of marriage? The way this is explained in the Dharma Shastra is the following. Yes, this kind of marriage is allowed, is tolerable, but it has unequal consequences. It has unequal consequences. For instance, according to Manu, the son of a Brahmin by a Brahmin wife will have four parts of the ancestral property. His son by a Kshatriya wife will have three parts of the ancestral property.
his son by a Vaishya wife will have two parts of the ancestral property, and his wife by a Shudra will have only one part of the ancestral property. Now, this is not to say that every Brahmin typically had a Brahmin wife, a Kshatriya wife, a Vaishya wife, or a Shudra. This is not a description. It is an account of the logic of the system. And this is something that is very important, and in a way, this makes the Hindu caste system very different from the caste system or caste divisions. Some would say that the Sikhs don't have a caste system, the Muslims don't have a caste system, although they have caste divisions. It is only the Hindus who have a proper caste system. Whereas in India, Christians have caste divisions, Sikhs have caste divisions, Muslims have caste divisions, in Sri Lanka, Buddhists have caste divisions. But it's only the Hindus who have a proper caste system in the sense of something that people have thought deeply about, something that people have tried to represent, explain, and justify. In that sense, this has existed for a very long time. So, Varna is to be thought of as the thought-out order, as the conceptual scheme in terms of which the logic of the system is explained, whereas jatis are the actual divisions on the ground which are relevant for ordinary people in their day-to-day activity. What kind of occupation is open to you? How will you marry? With whom will you eat? And so on and so forth and all the rest of it. There are other differences between Varna and jati. One other difference is that the Varna scheme is very simple. There are four and only four, and the ranking of these four is fixed and inflexible. And I think I quoted this yesterday, but let me quote it again. The Dharma Shastras, not just Manu, the other Dharma Shastras also repeat this phrase. Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, these are the four Varnas and there is no fifth. And you know, the Varna scheme, incidentally, this is a bit outside my topic. The Varna scheme is a scheme not only for human society. It is a scheme for the whole world, for the whole universe, because the Purusha Sukta hymn in the Rig Veda, which is the oldest hymn describing the Varna system, in fact explains how not just human beings, but plants, animals, various other kinds of objects should be grouped into these four different Varnas. So it is a kind of comprehensive scheme which is simple in its basic outlines and which is clear in its... It doesn't have the untidiness or the messiness of the division into jatis and the problems of ranking that are associated with these divisions into jati. Secondly, the Varna scheme has been for at least 2,000 years invariant. That is, it has been the same Varna scheme that has been recognized by Hindus, whether in Kashmir or in the Punjab or in Tamil Nadu or in Gujarat or in Bengal. It's the same Varna scheme that has been acknowledged as the ideal scheme for Hindu society throughout. Of course, people, I have found in the 1960s, people could point out that this scheme is only an ideal. What exists on the ground is rather different. In other words, when I was doing my fieldwork in a village in Tanjore district, it is well known that in Tamil Nadu, people recognize the existence of only Brahmins and the rest are Shudras. There are no Kshatriyas or Vaishyas who are acknowledged as authentic Shudras.